one quiet compound isn't going to be a good fit, but ultimately we can narrow down several million molecules to 10, 8, you know, that are synthesizable and meet all the characteristics that we need.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is how to use AI to identify novel drivers of disease and then design novel molecules for those diseases in silico. Neurodegenerative diseases arise when nerve cells in the brain or other parts of the nervous system lose function and eventually die. Currently available treatments may relieve some of the symptoms and they may slow down the progression of the condition, but there are no known cures. Using the current traditional methods of drug discovery with high throughput screening, the traditional players in the pharma industry have been unable to tackle these elusive neurodegenerative disorders. So these include things like Alzheimer's and their related dementias, Parkinson's, motor neuron diseases, spinal muscular atrophy, hereditary spastic paraplegia, primary lateral sclerosis, progressive muscular atrophy, and pseudobulbar palsy. So these conditions collectively affect around 6 million people in the US alone in a year and are responsible for around 270,000 deaths per year and around 3 million disability-adjusted life years in 1 year alone. So today, to tackle this problem, I'm with Max Dordovic, who's the CEO and co-founder of NeuroX1, which is a company that utilizes AI to identify and treat neurological diseases that affect millions of people every year. So they're bringing their novel approach to the industry and working diligently on bringing viable drug candidates into clinical trials sooner and reinvigorating the pipeline for drug targeting, not only for neurodegenerative disease, but other types of neurological and neuro-oncological disease as well. Sorry about the long intro, Max. It's great to have you on the show.
No, you're fine. No, appreciate you having me.
Can we start with a little bit about your background and how you got into this and how you led, what led you to co-found NeuroX1?
Sure. So slightly unconventional route into this world, but thought I wanted to be a doctor. And I thought, you know, hey, before I, commit to 4 years of med school and years of residency, how about I dabble in some biotech and some research and things like that and see if I really, you know, this is something I really want to do. I always figured I was going to be a finance guy. And we'll get to that later. Kind of ended up.
Yeah.
All, kind of it all comes full circle. And I eventually did end up sort of working on the finance side. But did a bunch of, for several years, research, mostly on the clinical side of things, wet lab, things like that. Mostly in stem cells and regenerative medicine and, for all sorts of, indications, but, worked for Merck, briefly. And then I, started a company, after my grunt work doing, medical writing and publishing and all that sort of research.
Yeah.
And realized there was more money in what I was researching, by selling it than on the actual research side. So, started a company, did it for a couple of years, ended up selling that, did a stint in VC, was never a huge fan. Like the guys I worked with, but, wasn't really for me. That's why I say, it's all comes full circle, ended up being on the finance side of things. But then, didn't exactly like, sort of deploying capital and then just waiting. And so, I figured, I wanted to get into the startup side of things. I was driving home from work one day and I gave two childhood friends of mine initially one, and we roped his brother in, gave them a ring. They grew up down the street from me. And I said, hey, not exactly sure our approach. I know I want to do something in neuro, but do you want to start a drug discovery company? We can flush out the details, but is this something you'd be interested in? He's a physicist and his brother is a, so that's Connor. He's a PhD in physics. And then his brother's a machine learning engineer with an experience in sort of healthcare data pipelines, applied math, that sort of thing. And we essentially, sort of my background on the biotech side of things and you know, clinical development and whatnot, with their background in, you know, this is going to sound kind of convoluted, but because physics underlies chemistry in the way drugs are designed, physics actually as sort of at a high level, you know, or to the layman might go, okay, that really doesn't make a lot of sense. Is incredibly applicable to drug discovery because you have rational drug design, below that you have structure-based drug design and kind of, you know, subordinate to that is, and sort of the way things are traditionally done, physics-based drug design. So that is why the physics makes sense. And then, his brother brother Lucas, he was, you know, as a computer science, by math guy, very familiar with GPT at the time. And so while we don't use language models to design drugs, we figured, okay, we can apply conceptually, you know, as I'm sure everybody by now is familiar with ChatGPT 3.5, 4, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, whatever. You know, everyone's familiar with that, but conceptually sort of those ideas are applied to physics-based simulations. So you're able to sort of have this rapid, you know, iterative cycle to get these drugs into the, you know, clinic, so to speak, you know, much faster than you might otherwise. But that's sort of the origins of it. A little phone call to a good friend of mine and you know, we're off to the races.
Sounds like a perfect mix, actually, the three of you. You've got such complementary skills for this kind of thing. When did you do this? When did you found the company?
So I think our formal incorporation date is the 18th of November of 21, but this was back in, this is October of 21 where we, you know, thought, okay, let's, this is something that we should do, you know, assuming we can raise capital around it and there's some appetite for this, let's, you know, give it the old college try.
Yeah. And so can you tell me about what you actually do in the company? What are the areas that you really focus on with drug discovery and development?
Sure. So we focus on the, you know, if you think of a doctor writing you your prescription as the end of the line, you know, so to speak, in the healthcare system, we're the exact opposite end of the spectrum. So we are the literal very start of, you know, somebody goes, okay, you know, maybe before that, you know, somebody goes, okay, we're interested in MS or we're just in Alzheimer's or something like that. Well, where do you get the drug? Where does the drug come from? How do you, you know, it's, you know, what, where do we even start? Now again, there's people that are much older than I am with much more wisdom that, you know, can give a, you know, really concise answer to that. But, you know, the way I like to put it is you have a target. In the case of Alzheimer's, amyloid beta is sort of the traditional target that everyone goes after. And then we basically from there, hopefully I'm answering your question. From there, basically plug that target into our, you know, algorithm and we call it Chiron is our generative, platform. And, from there, essentially design compounds for that target. So in the case of Alzheimer's, amyloid, you're trying to prevent, ideally slow the buildup of that plaque. So every approved drug for Alzheimer's right now slows the buildup of that. Is there something you can create that? Now, again, this is, again, we Alzheimer's is, I mean, sorry, for Alzheimer's, we only know what causes it. There's a million theories. Our best, but at the end of the day, the byproduct of it is amyloid. And so that's sort of the most common target. We plug that crystal structure into our platform and just design millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of compounds. There's somewhere like 10 to the, something like 10 to the 33 to 10 to the 70 drug-like molecules that are hypothesized to exist, which is a lot of zeros. and the largest compound libraries are several billion, which is, you know, only a, you know, fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what possibly exists.
Yeah.
So we then, you know, in you know, only a couple of days, we don't have to, doesn't take us that long. Can design, again, I'm being a little, you know, I'm glossing over a lot here, but.
Well, don't, because a lot of people listening will be Errol in the farmer industry. So feel free to go into more detail on it.
Sure. But, I mean, the important part is basically these aren't language models. These are physics-based simulations that apply, you know, all sorts of different, again, my background is definitely more on the clinical side, the business side of things, than it is the actual underlying, you know, comp sci and you know, physics that goes into this sort of thing. But at the end of the day, you're basically, you have this recursive process where it's just, it learns, okay, well, this molecule binds. Okay, great. Yeah. It binds. Well, now we have to optimize for blood-brain barrier permeability, neurotoxicity, hepatotoxicity, you know, CD50, like all the, you know, there's a million different characteristics that you have to, you know, account for. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, traditional high throughput screening outputs, you know, a hit would be something, you know, in our case, that, you know, binds. You know, if traditional HT, you know, high throughput virtual screening generates one hit in every 1200 molecules we generate or screen, basically, we get about 1 in 70 hits. So it's a lot more accurate. And then from there, basically you determine, okay, well, here are the, you know, of the million molecules that I identified in, you know, a couple of days, you generate, you know, several million molecules. A lot of them are not going to be synthesizable. You know, they're not going to be a hit. You know, there are a million reasons why, like why a compound isn't going to be a good fit, but ultimately we can narrow down several million molecules to 10, 8, you know, that are synthesizable, meet all the characteristics that we need. And we can do that in, there's a good example is there's this drug, currently in development by a major pharmaceutical company, for the treatment of MS. And, that is it's a very good drug, but it got a clinical hold for elevated liver enzymes. And again, it was two patients, you know, it was nothing crazy, but a clinical hold, a clinical hold. And so, we basically were like, all right, how many novel synthesizable compounds can we come up with? And they kind of figured, okay, the drugs we were going to come up with are going to be structurally unique, but the way that we sort of did this comparison was it didn't, we basically took out this drug we made sure our algorithm, when we ran this experiment, it didn't know this drug existed, essentially. And so they sort of thought, all right, you're going to come up with a handful that are structurally similar, whatever. And we came up with 8 synthesizable molecules and met all of our criteria that had more favorable characteristics and more favorable, you know, efficacy to the extent that you can measure that computationally. And we found that it took them 2 or 3 years to identify that compound. And it took us 138 hours to identify 8 that are theoretically better than that drug. And again, there's a lot more that goes into it on the, once you actually synthesize that drug, start doing in vitro assays, start doing in vivo assays and, you know, identify a lead.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, we're able to do this substantially faster than, you know, sort of the old way.
The old way.
It's just guess and check and guess and check and just do that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Until you eventually sort of the best analogy that we have, and this is probably dumbing it down, but, you know, the old way is you had a big keychain and you're just, you know, key, lock, you know, some of them turn halfway, some of them turn a little bit, some of them fit, some of them don't.
Yeah.
Eventually you're going to find a couple that turn the lock, and those are going to be the compounds you end up, you know, taking into the lab. What we do is
that's really cool.
We mold the key to the lock is how we like to describe it. We these are the parameters we need to beat. And, you know, you throw enough compute at it and, you know, a lot of, you know, very smart people, and you can, you know, create some drugs that are substantially better. Again, computationally, again, the biology is complicated, and the second you put these in the wet lab, how they are going to behave is sort of anyone's guess. But with, you know, traditional methods that are validated, you can then take these drugs that are, you've designed these novel compounds that, that you're pretty confident are synthesizable with like 99.5% you know, accuracy, and say, all right, these are the ones you're going to want to take into that are worth screening in the lab, and kind of going from there.
Very cool. So basically, there's kind of two main areas. One is the accelerated target identification, and then the next one is the preclinical in silico preclinical testing. So with the in silico preclinical testing, so basically, if someone brings a compound, they've already identified their target, right? Or you've identified the target, one of you's identified it. And so then you put it into the testing. And basically, by doing that, you're going to have a pretty good idea if it's going to work in clinical trials how you want it to. Is that right?
Yeah. So this is sort of where it becomes a, well, you know, let's have it. You know, bring me back on the podcast in 10 years and I'll let you know how, you know, all this goes. But right now, you know, other companies that are older than us that do have, you know, quote unquote, you know, AI generated molecules that are currently in phase one or phase two studies. Yeah. They've identified these hits. And again, this is a very capital intensive process, you know, you tend to want to partner with pharma companies to take these into the clinic. But there's a handful of drugs that have been designed, truly been designed generatively. They're mostly for oncology. It's lower hanging fruit. The failure rate there is only 90 to 95%, which is still high, but it's, you know, still lower than neurodegenerative. This is more into white space in neuro. You know, so far the results have been good for some of the later stage companies, in our space, again, mostly oncology, but, they've identified these compounds and, you know, they've basically gone from a target and nothing to a drug, you know, an IND enabling study, ultimately into a phase one clinical study, in 12 to 18 months, which is probably half the time that it takes for your average, you know, pharma company to take something into the clinic. Again, this is very disease dependent, and there's like, this is such a nuanced industry. But it's about a year typically, in the cases that I've seen from later stage companies. Capital intensive process, but, and this is why we sort of partner with pharma companies initially, because they are the experts in their given disease, and we're experts in the AI, and sort of that synergy is really what is able to accelerate that process.
And so with the data that you use, so you're using clinical and biological data like genomic, proteomic, patient medical histories, etc. Does that come, do you have access to all of that now, or do your clients provide that?
So on the target ID side, we incorporate a bunch of, quote unquote, multiomic data. So this is, you know, proteomic, metabolomic, transcriptomic, multiomic, like everything under the sun, on the target ID side. On the discovery side, it actually doesn't require that much training data in order to, the most important data to have is, what have you guys tried that hasn't worked, or doesn't, you know, what data do you have where you go, we've tried this is not, you know, we've tried these compounds, these don't work. That's helpful to know, you know, what drugs have you found that do bind? You know, do you want something covalent, non-covalent, reversible, reversible covalent inhibitor? You know, do you want to, you know, there's a million, you know, do you want an agonist of some kind that didn't work? Have you tried non-covalent? Have you, it's just, that's the most helpful data to have in terms of the, deciding what drug is going to be something that is worth taking into, synthesizing and taking into the wet lab, because it's what really chews into your costs are not the, it's not the compute. It's not the, again, there's a lot of, capital that goes into designing these algorithms and, building out a team and whatnot, but the, where it starts to get really expensive is synthesizing molecules, running these in vitro tests. You know, you're running the right tests. Are you, once you get into doing vivo studies, are you doing the right testing to determine, is this drug worthy of more resources? Because, ultimately, you're narrowing down millions, to billions of drugs to one.
Yeah.
So you have to be really confident in that. And so we want to put ourselves and our partners in a position where they're really confident that the compound that they're taking into the clinic is worthy of that, capital outlay, because that is a huge, it's the preclinical development process is expensive, but it's decreasing that failure rate is where you actually save the end customer a lot of money. Not a lot, sort of a like ungodly amount of money. It's
so how much do you think you could save a pharma company by doing that? Roughly.
It's hard to put a number on it. Because you have, again, the failure rate is so high in general.
Yeah.
The most of the money that you're saving them is, again, it's you're saving them, to us, a substantial amount of money. To them, rounding error on their balance sheet. Where you end up saving them a lot of money is, okay, is this drug that I, am sort of, betting the house on going to work? And is it going to fail? If you can bring that failure rate down a couple
early
percent,
as well. Because you don't want to get all the way through clinical and then fail. Yeah.
You want to fail really fast.
Early.
Or you don't. Or you want it to go
all the way.
So that is where, again, this is to be seen. No truly generative drug has, it takes 7 to 10 years on the fast side to get a drug into the clinic. To get a drug approved. Being a reasonable 10 to 12 is sort of, more realistic. But that is where it's to be seen. Again, if you can drop the failure rate down a couple percentage points, it's worth it.
Yeah.
But I can't say, hey, we can increase the odds of approval by 20%. Well, we don't know that. Nobody knows that. Even the most well-funded drug discovery companies on the planet don't know that. Because they haven't, no truly generative molecule has been approved. Now people sort of argue this, like they're one of the Biogen drugs that was approved for Alzheimer's recently, that brought the failure rate down from a whopping 99.6% to a 99%. Some argue is like sort of the first AI design drug, but again, that was 10 years ago, 7 to 10 years ago. I mean, it wasn't like generative drug design was really, it wasn't even close. That really was more machine learning accelerated hybrid screening than it was like, oh, we're just going to make this, generate this drug with, again, hard to put a, all the evidence is indicating that that's going to be the case.
Yeah.
In terms of bringing the failure rates down. But again, it is to be determined, I'm back on in 7 to 10 years and I'll let you know.
Yeah, I will. Because it's just such a huge problem in the industry, you know, the high failure rates. And that, of course, is part of the reason it costs so much to get a drug to market. You know, you're spending so much on all the failures.
Pharma does a really bad job on the messaging. I think they need a better PR firm.
Because
I think people don't understand. You know, you go, oh, like, you know, we got to have price controls or whatever, you know, whatever for XYZ drug, which, whatever side of the argument you fall on, the one thing you can't deny is like, it costs $2.5 billion, you know, maybe a little less to get a drug approved, but that's accounting for all the drugs that failed.
Yeah.
I mean, for every, you know, they have, you know, if, you know, one drug is going to fail and or what, you're going to have one drug succeed, you know, have nine others that failed. So it's not like it costs $2.2 billion to bring the one to market. It's like you had so many fail before that.
Exactly.
You
know, yeah,
For every hit, I mean, it's almost like the pharma companies are sort of venture capitalists at this point, where they just go, okay, how much money can we just throw at all these different modalities and therapies?
And one of them's going to work. Yeah.
Technologies. Someone's going to work. We just don't know which one's going to work. So let's sort of hedge our bets. And that's where, again, I'll stop rambling on this point, but
that's good.
But that's sort of where pharma sort of evolved into that. Not to say they don't have, like, you know, incredibly smart people working for them, and you know, they do bring their own drugs, you know, to market occasionally. But a lot of drugs in recent, you know, at least in my lifetime, I think 60 or 70% have been basically purchased out of biopharma companies or smaller biotechs. At some phase, you know, it's phase two, and then they take it
out of small biotechs and academic institutions. Yeah, totally. So, have you got any pharma clients at the moment?
Yeah, we have two biopharma clients at the moment. They're smaller biotechs, but we are sort of in talks with a handful of larger, probably five of the top 20. Players have sort of been talks with to work out a deal. We've been around since 21. So, you know, these deals can take, you know, anywhere between 8 and 12, you know, six months would be a quick deal.
It would be, because pharma do their
cycles.
I was going to say, pharma always do their budgets a year in advance. So anything you sell this year is not until next year.
Well, they do their pipelines 10 years in it. You know, they figure out, you know, hey, well, our patent for this drug is going to expire in 10 years. What gaps do we have to fill? Against who do we, against, you know, if I'm making these up, but like, all right, so if you have Merck and you have Lilly and you have Pfizer and they all have some currently approved neuro drug for whatever indication, well, they have to go, okay, well, what does Pfizer have in phase one now? And, you know, that's going to get, you know, what are the odds of that getting approved for this? And then, okay, well, we think we can compete here, you know, and we pull this, and they plan their pipelines 10 years in advance. And so you kind of have to be thinking both doing these deals a year ahead of time, but then also looking at these pipelines of these various pharma companies and go, well, who makes the most sense to partner with? Who makes the most sense to, you know, work with from a, like, oh, we want a drug for neuro. Because again, the areas sort of become hot and not, you know, it ebbs and flows, you know, sort of like any other industry. But neuro is definitely a graveyard.
It's a real problem
to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess with your current
clients. And we have some academic collaborations as well.
Okay, good. And with your current clients, are they more focused on the in silico preclinical testing or on target identification, or where are you seeing the most demand at the moment?
100%. So essentially, they have come to us with targets that they're interested in, and you know, we go, okay, this target, you know, and they come to us with a target and an indication, and then we go, all right, that makes sense. You know, this makes sense. You know, you think you've gone through this. You guys are subject matter experts in this particular disease area. How can we, you know, when we basically pull out structure and we generate molecule after molecule after molecule, you do that for, you know, days and weeks, you know, at a time. And you know, to give you the biggest set in which to, you know, the biggest funnel to narrow down. And, you know, you hand off 10, 20, 30 compounds. And then you basically send those off to a CRO. Again, we want to be asset light. We really don't want to, you know, we want to stick to our core competency, which is the computational discovery. Leave sort of the wet lab work to CROs and other partners. And we say, all right, synthesize these, you know, run some in vitro experimentation on them. You know, ultimately go get some in vivo data and say, all right, these are the three we think are worth taking into into, you know, that are worth exploring. You know, here again, we'll give you all your 20 molecules. We think these three are probably your best bet. You know, they take a look at it and they go, all right, whatever. And then they, you know, take it the rest of the way. There's milestones leading into those contracts. There's royalties sort of on the, if that drug gets approved. But again, these things are so,
I can't such, ask you.
Such a long cycle that they're taking on a lot of clinical risk. So we don't see as much upside as a wholly owned molecule. Something we're considering in the, you know, as we grow, but you know, for the most part, we just want to make sure that they're getting the best molecule into the clinic, and that they and we all, you know, we're all sort of aligned on sort of our confidence in that particular drug.
Yeah. So you mentioned at one point about taking around 130 something hours. So how long does it take once a client comes to you and wants you to do this? Is it like a few weeks?
So this is where it gets interesting. So this is where it gets interesting. So there's nothing stopping you from just running it for a year. I mean, if you wanted to, you wouldn't do that. Obviously, you know, time is of the essence with these sorts of things. But you'd run it for a month or two, to really be, you know, to really be
confident,
you know, confident that we've looked at everything that makes sense. And it, you know, and you take the, you know, tens of thousands of hits you're going to get from that, you know, hundreds of thousands of hits, you know, especially if you ran it for a month, you know, more than a month, to be sure, like, okay, we've really nailed this, to the best that we can determine. You basically from there go, what's synthesizable, you know, of those compounds, and then run a couple of calculations on it, do some retrosynthetic analysis, and then say, all right, hey guys, here's 30 or 40 that we think are worth it. Yeah. Here's five that we really think are worth it.
Again,
you guys are the subject matter experts in this particular disease, so have at it. But this is what we think is your best shot.
Really nice. And so what's next for you guys?
Next, is next in now. So right now we're raising another round of capital to expand the team. A lot of our constraints are just, you know, we're a small team. We're about 10 folks right now. A couple part-time, but for the most part, you know, about 8 full-time, 10 folks working on this. All super bright, you know, world-class, relatively young team, although we have a couple guys that are really old at about 50. I'm joking, of course, but, you know, we get two guys on the team, I joke, that are sort of the adults in the room. because this is such a nascent field, you do need some people that have sort of been there, done that on the traditional computational chemistry side of things to go, you know, I was at Park Davis in 1990 and this didn't, we did this way, and it just didn't, we just could not get it to work. Yeah. And sometimes that's a function of, it was 1990 and the computers weren't as fast.
Yeah.
And in some cases it's just because it's not feasible. And so a lot of the, you know, whether it's our advisors or it's, you know, a couple guys on the team, you know, they're really good gut check, but then we also have guys on the team that are, you know, we've a guy on the team that, you know, our director of AI, for instance, relatively fresh PhD, but he, you know, he's probably the first batch of folks to really, you know, have a degree. You know, his PhD is literally in, you know, AI, technically AI protein design is sort of his like field, but it's, he wears a lot of hats. He is bioinformatics, you know, machine learning software development. Like he wears a lot of hats, but he's, super bright, but definitely the first sort of batch of folks to really graduate with the expertise in this sort of thing.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. Well, congratulations of getting so far in just 2 years. That's pretty impressive. I'm sure there's lots of people listening that would be interested in doing this, particularly given the high failure rates that we're seeing in the industry. So if anyone listening wants to get in touch with Max and his team, if you go to www.neurox1, and that's not spelt out one, it's the number one.com.
Number one.
Yeah, number one, neurox1.com, and get in touch with them. So thank you so much for telling us about this.
If you do hello at neurox1.com, we're probably a lot more likely to reply. The website's, some stuff comes through the website, but email is probably the best way to reach out to us.
Okay.
It's exciting times in the industry. I know generative AI has gotten a lot of press on the regular language model. You know, it's fun to type in and whatever, do some research, but in terms of practical applications of this sort of tech, life science, I think, is definitely going to be the way forward for the next couple of years.
And it will make such a huge difference if we can speed up and reduce the failure rate and speed up getting a drug to market. It means that we can do it cheaper, and that will have a knock-on effect on drug pricing and everything else. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, really important.
That's the goal.
That is, yeah. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, Dr. Bates, appreciate being here, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.